Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's May the 24th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. We haven't let off the show with an email for a while, so let's begin with a message I got from Devin in California, to whom I have to give an A-plus for honesty. Dear HAC, you asked us what we think Radio Free Northwest needs, and here's my answer. What I think the show needs is to demonstrate to its more skeptical audience the Northwest Movement's moral certainty or moral superiority to justify itself as the correct movement for our folk above all the others. Now, to some it may not be their destiny, but to the whites who still feel some kind of moral obligation or lack thereof due to soul-deadening cynicism, the show needs to prove to white America that the Northwest Independence Movement is what will save our future. Moral credibility over all else is what our people need. Here you're going to ask why I care and why I'm not going up, why I haven't sent you a mailing address. Other than money to get a proper, discreet P.O. box to protect my privacy from people who it's none of their business what mail I get, and the lack of gainful employment to acquire such a resource, my reason is essentially the same. It's the lack of certainty that if I follow some old man's internet ramblings into a land of nothingness, surrounded by rich, evil, yuppie faggots and people who hate me for what good I've set out to do, America will turn its opportunities away from someone who refused to play their game any longer. Yes, I know that's greedy and selfish and narcissistic, but what can I tell you? You're 100% right. I'm a 21st century American, not an 1850s pioneer, or a 1920s Italian, or a 1930s German. I need to know what's in it for me. I know this goes with the territory, but I don't know if I'll be able to make social connections with quality folks, find a good school to finish a degree, or necessarily find employment, especially with the likelihood that we're headed for a major economic crash and there will be little to fall back on. I think the scariest idea is being alone in a world in which everyone, including family, hates you for trying to do what's right and having nowhere to go except for menial labor that one will never escape, to be censured, slandered, assaulted, and humiliated without any course of action available to stop it, alone in a foreign land far from home, following some insane pipe dream while everyone else has moved on to financially rewarding respectable lives in Zog America. Reminded that non-whites, the shekel, and the pale-skinned PC human batteries own this land and look down on your presence if you are a tattooed freak. Depressing stuff, but I really think this is what white nationalists fear, as do I. I've received some good contact with one of the NF people through email. I hope they're all as nice as him. To be accepted into a friendly group would be an honor, even if it's eventually going to be much more than a social network. What the movement needs is a level of moral certainty and trust that they're going to something better, and that there is something above themselves to be pursued beyond their petty hatreds, no matter how justified they may be. I think you've covered this on RFN before. Devin. P.S. Thanks for the sense of urgency in last week's podcast. Should one search for a job and then pursue a degree in the homeland, or should one wait in their native state to get a degree even if it will delay resettlement? Quick answer to that question, yes, believe it or not, Devin, we actually do have colleges and universities and technical schools here, all kinds. Okay, Devin, you're right. I've gone over all this before, but like I've said before, I know that most of you haven't had the time to download and listen to the last 120 or so podcasts. And so every few episodes, I need to go back over the basics again. I've been maybe letting that slide a little too much, what with all the panel discussions and the guest speakers and whatnot, so let's take another crack at it. First off, although you don't state your age, from internal points in your email, I assume that you're a young man of late high school or early college age, and you're having problems with your parents, or you will have if they discover you in any contact with wicked, howable wastists like us. Well, welcome to the club. There are millions of young white people out there in the same boat as you, Devin. Yes, millions, if you count Canada and Europe and Australia. There is a very definite generation gap between the youngest white adults and their parents and grandparents, because the kids have grown up in a society that offers them less and less, and they have more and more had to confront in various ways a racial reality that their parents simply refuse to admit even exists at all. Now, don't worry, you're not alone. How do you think I got into all this myself? Little slice of integrated hell called Chapel Hill High School. So although you don't get into details, Devin, I think it's pretty likely that I know where you're coming from. Now let me redefine what you're saying down to its bare essentials. What you're saying is that you understand the idea of a white homeland here in the Northwest, and you like it, you'd like to see it happen, and you'd even be willing to help and participate, just so long as you don't have to go first, and somebody else does all the heavy lifting first. Once all the heavy lifting is done, and the tents and the picnic tables are set up, and the cakes and the ale are all set out, you're more than willing to come in and buy a ticket. And to be fair to you, you're willing to help out in the serving line and in the kitchen and make yourself useful, so long as you don't actually have to go first and get it all set up. In other words, once we can roll out a finished product, then you're our guy. Now, let me make it very clear here that I do not intend this in any way as nasty or critical, and I'm not putting you down, Devin. I'm not, really. Your take on this, your attitude, your view of things is very common indeed, and I run into it a lot. To your average American, this just makes sense. The very idea that they should actually be asked to risk something, to put something on the table in order to accomplish a goal that might be of some future benefit, is simply not in their mindset anymore. It's been bred out. Your viewpoint is obviously the majority one, as anyone can see who looks at our weekly stats for this show and compares them to the percentage of response and results we get. Now, your viewpoint is an obstacle that has to be surmounted if we're going to have hope in hell of getting this show on the road. Now, my failure to do so far is one big reason why the show isn't on the road yet. I just can't seem to find the right words. I can't get on the right wavelength to get through to people and explain to them that somebody has to go first and that it needs to be you. It's like trying to start a car with a dead battery. I keep turning the key and all I get is, but I'll crank it again. I won't go into our pioneer ancestors again, how they loaded up everything they owned in a Conestoga wagon and just set out across the plains into a completely unknown wilderness on a journey that lasted many months, whereas all I'm asking is for you to travel down interstate highways for a few days with comfortable motel beds every night. I've said that often enough, so I'm sure all of you have registered that bit. The big question is, if our four or five times great-grandparents could do this and we can't, why not? What exactly has changed? What did our great-great-great-great-great-grandparents have inside of them that we don't have? A lot of it, of course, is a matter of what we have by way of baggage that they did not. Now, we've been raised in a world that is essentially without real responsibility for anything serious. If we show up for our shit job on time every day, and we pay the liberal democratic state one-third of our income in taxes, and if we don't actually shoot down people on the street or burn down houses just to watch the glow, we're considered to have fulfilled our responsibilities and to be good citizens. Now, they were raised in a world where responsibility had a different meaning and was literally a matter of life and death. And that's the first difference between their world and ours. Life and death was not something they saw on a television screen. It was something our ancestors lived with every day, for real. Babies died before their first birthdays, a lot of them. Children died of diphtheria or polio. Young women died in childbirth or of consumption, which is what they called tuberculosis in those days. On the East Coast and in Europe, men, women, and children all died in horrible industrial accidents in the crude factories of the time. And don't even get me started on 19th century coal mines and those goddamn mills in the South. Up until about 1900 or so, real medicine as we know it today was practically non-existent. A simple cut could become infected, and you'd die of blood poisoning or tetanus because no one knew what germs were. The only painkiller available was laudanum, which was legal up to 1916. Add to that assorted acts of violence on the frontier or the Civil War, or animal attacks, which were a lot more prevalent back then, or poisoning from the lead in city water pipes, or a dozen other diseases like smallpox and scarlet fever and cholera that are now extinct, or just plain overwork. My God, do you have any idea what it took just to be a farmer in those days? The fact is that up until about 100 years ago, death was a regular visitor in most American households, much more so than today. The result was that people were a lot harder spiritually and physically. Our forefathers lived in a world without entitlement and without a safety net. The average lifespan was a lot shorter. Most people who survived adulthood died of natural causes in their late 50s or early 60s. I'm 58. I call myself the old man as a kind of a joke, but 150 years ago, I really would have been an old man. None of this living into your 80s and 90s on Social Security and Medicare like today. You were either born rich, part of the 1%, or you had a large family to take care of you, or else you died.
You see, back in those days, rich men would ride around in Zeppelins, dropping coins on people.
Oh, you could steal for a while, and considering the punishments in those days, I have to admit it took some guts to be an outlaw or a criminal. But if you'll read your history books, you'll see that most outlaws died young and with their boots on, this being before the time of our present enlightened and compassionate judicial system.
So how do you know so much about American history?
I pieced it together, mostly from sugar packets.
Okay, so what am I getting at with this long Grandpa Simpson ramble? Now, clearly, the act of commitment that I am demanding from all of you, this perfectly legal act, which is in fact to your personal advantage as well once you get done and settled in the homeland here, is nowhere near as difficult as the one that our ancestors undertook under somewhat similar circumstances a century and a half ago. But we won't do it. Why? Because basically, where they were strong, we are weak in every sense of the word. Devin, you ask why we are morally superior to various other so-called movements out there. It's because we are real, or at least we seek to be. These other so-called organizations exist solely on the internet, in many cases consisting of nothing but blogs or maybe a V-bulletin board, some of which have been operating for years without one single tangible accomplishment anywhere off the internet. The Northwest Front demands of you not a filled-out membership application or even dues. With us, your membership number is your zip code. You earn it by coming here and making your life here, in the land that destiny has appointed for our people's last chance to stand up and take our own lives and future back into our own hands. We demand of you a physical act committed in the real world, Northwest migration, which, although perfectly legal in and of itself, does in fact involve some degree of personal risk and inconvenience. If you'll pardon me, yet another Hollywood movie reference, there's a scene in the movie The 13th Warrior, where one of the Northmen tosses the Arab scribe a big broadsword. The Arab complains, "I cannot lift this," and the Viking replies, "Grow stronger." That's why we're morally better, Devin. Because we dare to make demands of you. And the first demand we make is that you cease to be a white boy and become a man. We demand that you grow stronger in every sense. No one else does.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally, and I'd like to respond to those who wanted some more information about me and my background and my current activities. Here's something of a timeline, so you can see there were no stints in prison, as some have suggested there must have been. I was born in Oregon, got married in 2001, had a couple of kids, got divorced in 2005, finished university in 2008 after first changing my mind and getting another degree from another school in 2007. I didn't even care about the first degree anymore, but I didn't want to leave a project unfinished. I stayed in Oregon and worked in my chosen profession, then moved to Montana for no apparent reason at all, then made it up to Washington in order that I may hear myself talk on this thing. See, I didn't even have time to go to jail. As far as current activities, I've said on my blog that I'm a really boring person and I don't see that changing. I read and write a lot, and I'm an athlete starting the competitive season, which means I speak to no one and do nothing outside of work, family, reading, training, and eating until the season ends, sometime around Thanksgiving. People ask me how I can find time for all this stuff, and it's simple. I don't clutter up my life with things that do not matter. I just don't have time to watch movies or hang out in bars or socialize at all with people who do not do exactly what I do. I don't get to go shopping or water skiing or camping. I just don't have time. I can afford to buy the things I need for myself because I don't clutter up my life and my space with things I do not need. I do not own a television. Why would I? I don't have time to watch anything, first of all, and a TV is nothing but a time waster and, in my opinion, a gauge for measurement of one's worth as a person. The more TVs you own, the more of a useless Jew you are. I have a friend who just got his cable shut off, and you'd think his cat died for how mopey he's being. Why do people pay $200 a month to sit and watch flickering images on a screen? I reminded him he could always read a book, and he looked at me like I was some kind of insane weirdo. What else can you buy with $200 a month? That's gas for a lot of people, so if you ever find that you can't afford to drive to work or anywhere else, blame your TV. $200 can feed someone for a few weeks, so if you find yourself scrimping on meat, blame your TV. If you don't send the Northwest Front at least $10 a month and you own a TV, I think we figured out what your problem is. Let me appeal to you losery types another way. The less you spend on cable, the more beer you can drink. But maybe you have plenty of money and you pay off all your obligations and send a few bucks to your favorite racialist organizations and you think it's worth a couple $100 to be able to watch Ultimate Fighting. Even if money means nothing to you, I guarantee there is one thing you are short on: time. Many deathbed regrets center around never having enough time to do various things, like quality activities with family members or interesting vacations, or maybe even bettering yourself through education that typically involves reading lots of books. But I have good news. It doesn't have to be this way. You do have time to do all the things you want to do, and all you have to give up is maybe 4 or 6 hours out of your day where you sit on your butt and eat chips and drool. So, comrades, cancel your cable, use the money to buy some ammunition, and shoot your TV. Every shot you fire is a needle in the eye of the loathsome Jew that spits all over your soul. So, that's it. That's my exciting life. I can spend $3 on a pen and notebook and keep myself entertained for months. If I can't read it, eat it, or use it for self-defense, it's useless to me, and therefore I do not buy it. If an activity does not serve the cause, serve my own family, or somehow improve myself, it's not a worthwhile activity. The best thing is, if I did go to jail, I'd never get in any arguments about what TV show to watch. It disturbs me to see so many young white women wasting their lives in bars, spending money on something they really don't need, and spending their time in an environment that is infested with non-whites. If they have families, they are doing no good for them in a bar, and if they do not have families, that is not the best place to be meeting good white men. White people are supposed to be better than the mud races, and therefore must also be held to a higher standard of behavior. Just because unaware whites and Jewish scum spend their youth under the influence of various substances does not mean that whites need to act this way as well. When we think of white pride, wouldn't it be nice to have an image of a wholesome person who is living like a member of her great race and not some drunk with trashy tattoos throwing up on herself? What about that speaks of pride in your race? I believe the white race should be a showcase of self-control, family values, and superior character. Of course, some youthful rebellion in moderation is normal and perhaps even desirable. As Aryans, we should have the ability to exercise self-discipline when it comes to enjoyable substances, and if we already know that we lack that discipline, it's our responsibility to avoid those substances and the places one may find them. We do have this choice. There are many among us who have stopped their destructive drinking habits and started living like proud white people. When alcohol becomes your main form of entertainment, and nearly every picture of you with your friend shows you with a glass in your hand, maybe not enough of your time is being occupied with thoughts of advancing the white race. Many white nationalists do not drink, and there's nothing wrong with that. What is the worst possible thing that could happen from never wasting an evening in a bar? What are you missing out on? And if you're the one posting all those drunk pictures of yourself online while trying to promote whatever racial organization you belong to, what message does that send about your group? Have a look at several happy white couples and try to find out where they met each other. Odds are it was not in a bar, unless they are both active alcoholics. What decent white man wants to meet a woman who makes a fool of herself, wastes her money, and destroys her body and mind? What sort of man do you expect you will meet in some loud club that plays jungle music? If I were looking for a quality white man and not a drunk, I would try religious or educational environments. I'm sure that white men would want to meet women in similar places. And white women who spend a lot of time losing their inhibitions in places inhabited by dangerous non-white scum may find themselves the victims of dangerous and degrading acts. We all know that these black animals have a habit of preying upon white women. Why would anyone willingly spend their time among these creatures? What makes you think you will be safe? Don't rely on the club owners and security to help you when they care more about how many trashy blacks they can convince to come in and spend money. You may not even be able to seek help from the white men there, since they may be wiggers and race traders as well. We all know that long-term use of alcohol destroys our bodies. Chronic alcoholics have a certain look about them when they get older, and it's a broken-down, sad look, not one that says white pride. Racially conscious whites know how important it is to maintain the body as a fine-running machine, and you don't put junk into something you may need to use to protect yourself and your family. You would never willingly trash your car or your weapons, so why your body?
I think our featured musical guest this week will be an old fella from back out in my neck of the woods in Deep Gap, North Carolina. He was called Doc Watson. And if you've never heard him before, you're in for a treat.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been riding on the Tennessee stud. I had some trouble with my sweetheart's pa, and one of her brothers was about outlaw. I sent her a letter by my Uncle Fudd, and I rode away on the Tennessee stud. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud. We drifted on down into no man's land. We crossed that river called the Rio Grande. I raced my horse with the Spaniard's foal till I got me a skin full of silver and gold. Me and a gambler, we couldn't agree. We got in a fight over Tennessee. We jerked our gun, then he fell with a thud, and I got away on the Tennessee stud. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud. Got just as lonesome as a man can be, dreaming of my girl in Tennessee. The Tennessee stud's green eyes turned blue, cause he was a-dreaming of a sweetheart too. We loped right back across Arkansas. I whooped her brother and I whooped her pa. I found that girl with the golden hair, and she was a-riding on the Tennessee mare. Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud. Stirrup to stirrup and side by side, we crossed the mountains and the valleys wide. We came to Big Muddy, then we forded the flood on the Tennessee mare and the Tennessee stud. I put a little baby on the cabin floor, a little horse coat playing around the door.
I love that girl with the golden hair, and the Tennessee stud loves the Tennessee mare. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud.
Okay, we've got myself here, we've got Sally, we've got Action Andy, we've got the other Andy, Andy Donner, from our Seattle unit, and we've also got Earl Turner from wherever.
Yeah, from okay. Points unknown.
Yeah, from points unknown, from an undisclosed location.
We met him at the bus stop outside, and he looked lonely.
Yeah, I was down there looking for dry ice, and I found him instead. But
we brought him in because we don't have to give him a bottle of wine every time he says something.
You want to talk, actually, you want to lean down, that's fine.
One thing that's been on my mind lately has been not just the lack of solutions that other groups offer, but actually the ignoring of our own. And that may seem a little self-serving, but it really does frustrate me. When, for example, I have a massive amount of respect for Bob Whitaker, and I have a massive amount of respect for Horace the Avenger, because I've learned a lot from both of them. But at the same time, they have both said, for example, Bob Whitaker, one of his audio files called Incurable Fools, he admits towards the end of it. Well, I shouldn't say admits, because he doesn't claim to have a solution. He's only developing talking points, and there's a really good reason to do that. But he points out for all his listeners that, look, we're not offering a solution to anything. This is just a way for us to talk in the enemy camp.
Yeah, well, that's the trouble with 99% of the movement. They don't have any solution other than the continuance of the status quo, which is to continue to talk and talk and talk on blogs. And
they're standing and fighting.
No, Harold, I ain't going to go up to the Northwest. I'm going to stand and fight. Standing and fighting generally means sitting there tapping on a computer keyboard and exchanging emails and blog posts with their audience of 50 people and proving how clever they are.
Well, and it isn't just that either. I've been assailed a number of times on the internet. We all have. specifically over, what's with this Northwest Front thing? Isn't the mantra a solution? Well, yeah, the white genocide mantra is useful, but as Bob Whitaker has said, it's not a solution to anything. What baffles me even more is the average individual's inability to understand that a talking point isn't a solution. Whitaker has theorized that we're going to eventually be able to make use of United Nations anti-genocide laws to save the white race, and with all due respect to him, that's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Those laws weren't written for white people.
As I mentioned in Radio Free Northwest a few weeks ago, white people have this idea that to articulate a problem is the same as to solve it, and that's just not the case.
That reminds me of those white liberals who like to raise awareness of social problems and wear those little bracelets. They're just calling attention. Oh, look, there's a problem in the world, and I have this bracelet, and we're all aware now, and everything's great.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not about solving the problem. It's about making themselves feel good. A lot of conservatives have the same reason. A lot of, I think, racial nationalists have the same reaction because they do something like posting to a blog or maybe sending the odd $10 to a group like ours or any other group, but it's a way of salving their conscience. It's a way of convincing them that they're really part of the solution. They really are doing something, but they're not bringing about any actual change.
I think, in my opinion, most of the people that we want to convert or introduce to racialism as whites, they're not really going to be convinced, in my opinion, by facts. I think pretty much everybody on the planet, whites and brown people alike, accept the fact that white supremacism is not a theory, but a truth. That's why when you talk about whites being murdered or how whites are being displaced in countries, everybody's eyes roll back in their heads, because we all know deep down inside that the moment we all wake up, this shit's going to be done in a week. We all know that when niggers riot, they burn down a couple city blocks. But when whites get going, we're going to destroy whole nations. So I think part of it, this has to progress in stages. And because of whites not being woken up by sheer fact alone, we have to cause an emotional disturbance in people. And I know, Harold, you've talked in the past about how whites always have to feel unfortunately, that's what it is. That's what we have to deal with. Whites need an emotional reaction. And I think that's the strength, that's the beauty of the mantra that Bob Whitaker came up with and the Bugs people use and Horus the Avenger uses, is that once you introduce the idea, the kernel of the thought of white genocide, that yeah, your family's going to die, your children, your grandchildren are going to be raped and murdered and mugged no matter where you go. If you stand and fight in Louisiana, well, how's that turning out? You know, you stand and you fight in Florida, how's that turning out? You stand and you fight in South Carolina, how's that turning out for you guys? How is it in California where 39% of the students are illegal Mexicans in California? How's that standing and fighting, working out for you? We're all susceptible to white genocide. And I think we have to have this emotional response first before we can do anything. You guys are right. It's not solving the problem. It's not going to do anything unless there's further action. But before we can have any action, we have to have that conversion of the white soul.
Well, they say stand and fight. I think we need to really define what exactly it is we mean by fight. Tapping on a computer keyboard and posting to a blog is not fighting.
Right, and I'm also not advocating doing anything illegal at this point.
Well, that's the usual disclaimer. we all have to make. Well, it's not a matter of advocating, really. Now, kidding aside, my understanding is that as the law now stands, if we say, okay, everybody get together on Monday morning, we're all going to march down to the courthouse and burn the place down and kill all the lawyers, or we're going to kill Judge so-and-so, that's inciting to a specific illegal act. What I do is I make historic observations and legal and social observations. This was the crux of my Brandenburg lectures of last September, and I am not advocating violent overthrow of the government in the sense that I say, okay, let's everybody get together, get our guns, and go to Washington, D.C., and, you know, start slaughtering people or anything like that. I am simply pointing out that some kind of armed violent resistance to the government of the United States is a historical inevitability. The United States has degenerated into a tyranny, and an incompetent and corrupt and senile tyranny at that. Everything that we know about history, about human nature, and about the whole path of human existence in the past indicates that this is an open invitation to an armed rebellion, an insurrection, and the forcible replacement of the existing order with a new one. Now, the question is, of course, what will that new order that replaces the old one be like? Who will do the revolting? Who will be pulling the triggers? Who will be confronting the FBI and the cops and the army and all that sort of thing, and who will actually be left when the smoke clears away? That is what we have to decide. I would prefer, frankly, that it be the white man, but it may not be us. It may be the Mexicans. It may be the Chinese. I doubt it'll be the niggers because they're too stupid and disorganized. But the Chinese, maybe. The Mexicans, maybe. Who knows? We're just going to have to see. But try and bear in mind, making a observation about human nature and about history is not the same as inciting. And I'm not just saying that to cover my ass. It's what we do.
And it's probably a good time for me to tie a couple things together. What I'm told by a lot of people online is, oh, we're going to stand and fight. And let's tie that in with the whole historical observation thing. I'm sure frequent listeners to Radio Free Northwest will probably remember I was on a few months ago. I recently migrated to the Seattle area, well, Seattle specifically, at the very beginning of October 2011. And a lot of my things were just plain packed, so I had a couple books out. And one of them was March of the Titans. And one thing I took out of reading the historical accounts of a lot of, especially Roman provinces and former Roman provinces that were slowly browning out, is that the reason those areas are still partly have some white DNA in their mix is because of the people that were standing and fighting. Once a browning out process has started, standing and fighting doesn't work, and we've seen that it doesn't work every single time in history. Unfortunately, all of this talk about, oh, we know what the solution is, we're going to do that, we're going to advocate this, I'm sure all of that advocating went on time and time again throughout history, but at some point we're going to have to face the fact it didn't do anything, and once you're willing to face that fact, get in contact with us.
Well, let's face it, the term standing and fighting in the lexicon of sane, normal, rational people means resisting your enemies with force of arms and killing your enemies. And that is what I think of when I hear the term stand and fight. So if you want to stand and fight in Louisiana or Florida or Wisconsin or Texas or wherever, fine. More power to you. If someone, I think, actually were standing and fighting in the South or in Texas or someplace like that, then I probably would say nuts with this Northwest idea. I'm going to get my weapon and I'm going to go down there and I'm going to stand shoulder to shoulder with these people. Because if they've taken that leap of hope, you might say, then they might have a chance. But fighting and resistance and whatnot, all these terms that we bandy about, they don't really mean anything unless they mean what they're supposed to mean, which is killing your enemies. This is probably the essence of our problem for the past 50 years, past 100 years. The white man no longer kills his enemies, and our enemies know it. They have lost all respect for us, and they should do. Because historically speaking, humanly speaking, respect is earned by the shedding of blood. The white man has ceased to shed the blood of his enemies, and so we are no longer worthy of respect, either the respect of our enemies, the respect of our children, or our self-respect.
Nature decrees that if a people will not fight, then they will be replaced.
You know, I got some things. The problem that I have with the white nationalist community is that each individual group seems to think that their idea is better than the other. And then they'll fight amongst themselves. You have some white nationalists that don't like David Duke. You have some that like him, but maybe they don't like Tom Metzger. Or you have some people that listen to the Save White People podcast, and then they'll argue back and forth. And you have whites, and you don't see that with niggers. You don't see it with Mexicans. It's all about race to them. The bottom line, when the shit hits the fan, they're always going to pick their own side. Whites don't seem to do that. And that's a big problem. It's like just same thing with religion. You have Christians that believe maybe this thing. You got the Protestants and they believe this. And so we're going to argue amongst ourselves instead of being white first. And that's the main problem I have. And I get to the point where I don't even talk about racialism or white nationalism with other white people because, you know, you have some whites that want to maybe stand with Israel and some that don't. And some whites that maybe like this particular thing. And instead of identifying with your race first, they want to argue about these other things that don't matter. And so until whites identify as being that first, I don't see this movement. I've said it before, and I hate to use the term because some people don't like it, but I say that we're doomed. Because I'm just one guy. You're just one guy. He's just one guy. I can't make it all happen by myself. We need to stick together. We need to identify with being white first. I don't care if you're a Christian. I don't care if you're a this or that, as long as you're white first. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Who doesn't like David Duke? I don't know anyone like that. I'm going to vote for him for president.
Well, anyway, I think the central thing we have to bear in mind is the 14 words of David Lane. I think that is the sort of the litmus test, the ultimate expression of the entire creed or belief system that we all need to have, and that is that we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. The 14 words says it all. If you have a group or a leader or a white person or some kind of white movement and you're trying to assess whether or not they're part of the solution or part of the problem, see how they react to the 14 words. Do they believe in the 14 words? Do they accept and try to work for the 14 words? Because that is the ultimate definition of white nationalism as a racial philosophy. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. That says it all. It is not a religious creed. It is a racial one. And this is why in my novels and in my work with the NF, I try always to emphasize we have to be a movement of blood rather than faith or ideology. Now, we have people associated with the Northwest Front who are Christian identity. We have some who are pagans. We have some, like myself, who are National Socialists. And so we so far have been able to work together in harness quite well because we all have this one connecting thread, this one connecting idea, this ideal, that of the 14 words of David Lane. So any so-called white group that does not embrace the 14 words in some way, I'd be a little leery because that probably means that they're not quite totally with it. Another good saying, I think, is A.K. Chesterton's old saw about if they don't name the Jew, their message isn't true. A lot of neocons like Rush Limbaugh and even, say, Jared Taylor are very good on race. Taylor especially. His racial stuff is some of the best I've ever read. But absolutely refuses to discuss the Jewish problem. And you can't really discuss the white man's problems or Western civilization's problems without talking about Jews any more than you can discuss disease without talking about bacteria. So those two sort of very broad litmus tests, I think, do apply. A group, a movement, an individual must be familiar with and adhere to the 14 words involving racial survival, and they have to have at least some knowledge of the Jewish question, but that still leaves a very broad spectrum of people who can and should be working together.
Pretty much everyone in every white nationalist group I've known, they all claim, well, my group, you know, we're not like those others. We accept all white people and we promote white unity, just as long as it's not white people from that one group, because I don't like those guys and they suck and I'm not going to any white thing if that one guy's going to be there. But other than that, white unity, yeah.
I think offhand, there's two individual people that I would absolutely refuse to work with under any circumstances. I won't bother and name them. But other than that, if some of these people who have been attacking me and slandering me for the past 20 years, if they were to come to me and say, hey, Harold, look, you know, I still don't agree with a lot of stuff you did, but I admit things are getting bad now and we got to do something about this. And we need to sink all these differences. And we need to, you know, work together on this, that, the other thing. I would do it. Because I understand that we are running out of time. We simply don't have time enough left to continue to be involved in some of this crap we've been doing from the 1990s or anything like that. And as a matter of fact, I will go so far as to make an open invitation right now. Some of you know who you are. If you're one of these people who have been ranting and raving about me on the internet about things I did in the 1990s, I tell you what, I'm not worried about it. If and when you decide that you want to come and help us here in the Northwest, if you want to get with the program, if you want to assist us in any way, or if there's anything I can do for you, you let me know. Because the time is very rapidly approaching when all of these little disputes and all of these little feuds that we've been having are going to be of just no importance at all in the face of ultimate racial extinction. Somehow or other, we have got to rise above all this crap. This is Doc Watson and his son, Merle.
For to wind up the concert with tonight, we'll do a medley of two more of the old-time fiddle tunes. Salt Creek, or Salt River, I think the old tune was originally called. And that good old Bill Cheatham.
As I've mentioned in previous podcasts, I've been thinking about how we can streamline this show and make it much more effective in getting a response from you folks who are listening. In view of the almost certain impending Israeli attack on Iran, we need to hurry up and get on with it. Mainly, I'd like to get us out of the entertainment industry. Now, that's something that you need to bear in mind, that unlike so many, I've never viewed the movement as a form of entertainment, an outlook which, unfortunately, hasn't been shared by a lot of you down through the years. But the purpose of everything I do or say or write has always been to get you to respond in some positive manner. Specifically, to act in some way to support the 14 words, and in the past 10 years, more specifically, to get you to support the Northwest Imperative in some way besides the endless generation of words. Now, this has always been a big problem with the internet in that it generates nothing but more net. People see a good website or they hear a good podcast and they get all enthusiastic and inspired to create another website. Now, this has been the case for a long time. Those of you with long memories may recall something called the Knights of Freedom back in 1999, which was actually the first virtual Nazi party. Of course, it turned out to be run by a Jew named Andrew Greenbaum. You see what I mean about the nutty 90s? Okay, like I've said, the internet is the only medium of mass communication that our movement has access to, and we have to use it. But the problem is that the internet becomes an end in itself and not a means to an end. And that end must always be to get you to respond in some way besides the generation of more endless words. I believe I once mentioned on this program an old Hungarian freedom fighter I once knew, one of the teenage kids who was taking out Soviet tanks in Budapest in 1956. And he told me once, "Harold, you Americans are going to lose everything you have because you're fighting the greatest evil the world has ever known with nothing but words." Now, we don't have formal membership in the Northwest Front, as defined by applications and membership cards, and yet people seem to want that concept of being a member of something, which I suppose is humanly understandable. And so they keep asking me to come up with some kind of definition of a Northwest Front member. Now, so far we've been kind of going on with Lenin's old pre-1917 definition adapted to our own circumstances, which is that a member is someone who supports the creation of a sovereign nation here in the Pacific Northwest as a homeland for all the Aryan peoples of the earth and who actively supports that idea. But maybe a better and more succinct definition would be that a Northwest Front member is someone who supports the NF in some concrete way other than words. I personally would be inclined to throw some kind of residence requirement in there as well, but that's a whole nother subject. Okay, let me ramble back in the general direction of the point here, because time may at long last be running out for real. Now, I need to find some way to get through to as many of you as I can in these last remaining months we have over the summer. I'm assuming, as does most of the rest of the world, that the Jewish attack on Iran will take place in October, when Obama is bogged down in his re-election campaign and with Mitt Romney's lips glued to Israel's buttocks in the hope of getting enough Jewish votes to swing New York and Florida with their massive electoral college tally. Not to mention Jewish money, of course. Anyway, under those circumstances, Obama and the Democrats won't dare say boo to Israel. Now, the result is that whoever does take over in January 2013 will be facing a freezing country with almost 20% real unemployment, where gasoline and home heating oil have become virtually unobtainable by normal people, and the United States military will have been stripped to the bone around the world in order to provide enough manpower to conquer the Straits of Hormuz, establish a beachhead there, and keep the straits open for the oil tankers. Israel will be under heavy rocket bombardment and may even be facing a massive land invasion by the Persians, in which case the shit will really hit the fan in so many ways that no one can really predict all the ramifications, except that, as I said last week, I think the Northwest Front might benefit tangentially because the FBI will henceforth be too damn busy dealing with all the Iran-related madness and chaos this will certainly result in, and so they won't have time to waste listening to this podcast and harassing our participants. However, until then, one of the changes I think I'll be making is to kind of ease back on the panel discussions a bit. There was a purpose for them at one time, largely to refute the goat dancer's claims that Harold is all alone and nobody supports Harold and there's nobody in the Northwest, it's all an internet fantasy, so forth and so on. Now, that purpose has now been served. I think I've proven my point, and now we know for a fact that the regime does not like these podcasts, and they're starting to harass and annoy our panelists and try to threaten and intimidate them, I have to wonder if it's really fair to put them at risk. Now, one of my roles in the NF is to act as a public spokesman, specifically because I'm personally and financially bulletproof. I have no job and no family, no mortgage to worry about, no house, no wealth or property that they can threaten. But that doesn't apply to everybody, and I need to sit down with all of our regular guests and make sure that they understand that from now on there may well be a price tag attached to that First Amendment that we make use of. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. And don't worry, Axis Sally will still be around. As those of you who listened to her special podcast dated last Sunday know, they tried to frighten her into silence and they failed. I've gotten a very good response from that cast, and I know we're all proud of her. But the fact is that, in addition, the panel discussions, in a sense, are too much fun for everybody involved, including the listeners. And we're not here to have fun. We're here to try and get you to respond with something besides words. Now, if you simply listen every week, log off, and then do nothing until it's time to listen again next week, then this isn't working. Now, our numbers are up, for sure. I've learned to start measuring hits by the month and not by the week. I hope we may break 20,000 unique hits this month, although right now it looks like we may come up a little short. This is the key. I will say to you yet again, there are millions of white people out there who would respond to us if only they knew that we are here. We have to up that hit rate. I'd like to ask each of you listening to this, every week after the podcast finishes, please try and dig us up one new listener from your circle of acquaintances or off Stormfront or anyhow you can. Do that every week because it's literally the least you can do. Guys, I constantly complain about you doing nothing but tapping on your computer keyboards. Now, if that's all you're going to do ever, then so be it. But at least do that for us. Post. 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 Post the link to this website and this podcast. Generating words is my job, and I do it fairly well, even if I do say so myself. But those words are meaningless if nobody ever hears them.
Froggy went to courtin' and he did right, uh-huh. Froggy went to courtin' and he did right, uh-huh. Froggy went to courtin' and he did right, a sword and a pistol by his side, uh-huh. He rode right up to Miss Mousie's door, uh-huh.
Let me in.
He rode right up to Miss Mousie's door, uh-huh. He rode right up to Miss Mousie's door and he hit it so hard that it made it roar, uh-huh. Then Miss Mousie let him in, uh-huh.
Come in, Mr. Froggy.
Then Miss Mousie let him in, uh-huh. Then Miss Mousie let him in, and the way they courted it was a sin, uh-huh. He took Miss Mousie right on his knee, uh-huh.
Come here, you sweet thing.
Took Miss Mousie right on his knee, uh-huh. Took Miss Mousie right on his knee, and he says,
Miss Mousie, would you marry me, uh-huh.
Well, Miss Mouse, she says, I don't know about that, uh-huh. Miss Mouse, she says, I don't know about that, uh-huh. Miss Mouse, she says,
I don't know about that, but thank them soul, you have to ask Uncle Rat.
Well, what did he get for a wedding gown, uh-huh? What did he get for a wedding gown, uh-huh? What did he get for a wedding gown? A piece of hide of an old white hound, uh-huh. Now, where will the wedding supper be, uh-huh? Where will the wedding supper be, uh-huh? Where will the wedding supper be? Well, we'll be under in a holler tree, uh-huh. The first guest was a big June bug, uh-huh. First guest was a big June bug, uh-huh. First guest was a big June bug, and he danced all around with a half a pint jug, uh-huh. The second guest was a bumblebee, uh-huh. Second guest was a bumblebee, uh-huh. Second guest was a bumblebee, and he danced around with a fiddle on his knee, uh-huh. Pick one, Jack. Thank you.
Well, the third guest was a little gray mouse, uh-huh. He was a bride's brother. Third guest was a little gray mouse, uh-huh. The third guest was a little gray mouse, and he says, Mr. Froggy, can I rent you a house, uh-huh. He was a real estate man, you see. Well, now the frog, you know, he had to go on his honeymoon. So, Mr. Froggy went traveling across the lake, uh-huh. Froggy went to traveling across the lake, uh-huh. Yeah, he was a bullfrog. Well, the frog went to traveling across the lake, and he got swallowed up by a big black snake, uh-huh.
Some months ago, a young comrade in Louisiana created a bit of a stir when he actually took the trouble to read the entire Northwest novel Hill of the Ravens onto an audio file and publish it on the web as an audiobook. Since then, I've gotten a number of requests from people to read my own novels out loud so that they can download them and play them in their cars on their way to work or whatever. That's always struck me as a wee bit on the narcissistic side. And besides, I don't have either the time or the inclination to read a whole novel of mine out loud. But I got another request of the kind this week from a lady who's a real big fan, and on strength of her persuasion, I don't mind doing a few sections now and then during Radio Free Northwest, since I'm not making it up, and I have, in fact, gotten real multiple requests for this kind of material. For some reason, you guys seem to like it. Although I probably shouldn't make a habit of this kind of thing, since I genuinely don't want to appear to be too self-obsessed, and I mean it when I say this about it's the song and not the singer with me. But if some of you have favorite sections of the novels, and they're not too long, I can read them on here, and then you can make yourself a little audio clip or ringtone for your phone or whatever. Anyway, this is the opening chapter of the second Northwest Independence novel, A Distant Thunder. The title is The Turning Wheels. At the end of the 20th century, there was a Japanese college professor named Francis Fukuyama. He wrote a long, intellectual, and très chic essay called The End of History that became quite famous. Francis Fukuyama was an intellectual whore who sold his mind for money. He was a tame academic who sucked up to the wealthy and powerful of his era big time. He told them what they wanted to hear, and he reaped their largesse. When the blank-faced white men in the silk suits said, "Jump," Francis Fukuyama asked, "How high?" When the suits said, "Run," Francis Fukuyama asked, "How far?" He politely avoided the mildly disturbing term plutocracy and substituted a much more fashionable practice of publicly referring to the wealthy, corrupt, amoral, incompetent, discreetly homosexual Anglo-Zionist corporate ruling of the elite of the late 20th century by the grotesque name of liberal democracy. It was, of course, neither liberal nor democratic, but truth didn't matter in those days. Fukuyama argued that liberal democracy was the final form of human government for all time to come. He claimed that the allegedly irresistible combination of liberal democracy and multinational capitalism had triumphed over all other competing systems such as monarchy, fascism, communism, national socialism, welfare state socialism, and, of course, that nasty Islamic theocracy of the ignorant Arab peasants that persecuted poor little helpless Israel so. History was now at an end, Professor Fukuyama told the world. All that remained was to formalize that fact by taking care of a few little details and getting everybody on board and whipped into shape. Well, then once we got rid of all those picky little odds and ends, like race and religion and culture and morality and the traditional nuclear family, in other words, once we destroyed all that makes humanity truly diverse in the non-politically correct sense of the term, then all the nations of the earth would boogie down in one great conga line onto the great worldwide Euro-American consumer plantation. There mankind would graze in the grass, dancing and singing and blowing dope and fucking everything with a pulse, bathed in the warm, soothing glow from the television. The very flow of history itself would cease, and the Garden of Eden would be reborn, but instead of a serpent in our new paradise, we'd have only Ronald McDonald. The world would henceforth and forever be benevolently ruled from the corporate boardroom by pale, unseen beings in expensive suits, while at their shoulder, for spiritual guidance, whispered the holy Rabbi Hyman Hebelbaum from Temple Schmuckel, wearing his little blue and white knitted beanie. his heart filled with the brotherhood of man and confident in his ancient Talmudic knowledge of what is best for us all. Wrong, asshole. Dead wrong. The United States of America into which I was born was all a lie. A cheap, shoddy, vicious, evil lie that deserved nothing but bloody death at the point of a sword. In the United States of America, if you had a white skin and a dick on you, if you had no money, then you were nothing. Get back, redneck. No one cared about you. No one would lift a finger to help you. And all you were good for was to fix the rich people's appliances and toys. You were raw material for biped swine in suits to make money for themselves off your sweat and your pain. You lived your whole life like a dog. You were beaten like a dog, and you died like a dog. Well, by God, we showed those rich sons of bitches and their smart Jew lawyers and their pet monkeys that dogs have teeth. Oh, yeah. Amazing what a few well-placed bullets and a dab or two of Semtex under some rabbi's kosher tuchus can do to get the wheels of history jump-started and turned back on track. My name is Shane Ryan. I was one of those little details that Fukuyama and his kind could never quite take care of. I was a Northwest volunteer. This is how we started the wheels of history turning again. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.